This is Chatter on Books. Use only as directed.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well, staying healthy, staying dry. We are not here in your nation's capital. We've got several things going on, and we've got the lovely and talented Ron Charles joining us this evening, Washington Post book critic. Thank you,
Hello.
Ron, for coming back.
Thanks so much for asking me.
David Aldridge taking an important critical break from NBA playoffs. David, good to see you again.
Hello, good to be seen. Sorry about the caps.
Yeah, we'll do a little sporty thing in a second. So in a few minutes, we're just raving about this book. We're going to be talking about this fabulous book, Mecca, written by Susan Strait, which is, it's not what I expected.
No.
It was riveting. It is about history. It is about family. It is about race. It is about a lot of troubles, but I think, Ron, ultimately kind of optimistic. I felt better by the time I got to the end.
Yes, I guess I'd say that. It's pretty harrowing, though, isn't it?
Yeah, very harrowing. But it's spectacular. So we look forward to talking to Susan. First off, we've got to do our Gaithersburg Book Festival pitch. Ron, you've done the Gaithersburg Book Festival, haven't you?
It is one of my favorites. It is like Mayberry RFD meets Library of Congress. It is so charming.
Perfect. It's this Saturday. It's May 21. It's the first time they're doing it in person in a couple of years. Over 130 authors. They have every kind of book, every kind of author you'd ever want will be there. They have activities for kids. They have workshops for aspiring authors. They have food. They have free parking, which to me is a very, very big deal. And at approximately 4:15 in the afternoon, David and I, hopefully David and I,
yes,
will be there with Brendan Slocum and Jonathan Santlofer, who have two fabulous books, The Violin Conspiracy and The Last Mona Lisa. So that'll be a special Chatter on Books episode in person.
Oh, very cool.
That's great. It's really great. We've had Judd Ashman on a couple of times, Ron, the mayor of Gaithersburg, who really created the festival.
He is the saint of Gaithersburg. He's amazing.
He is the saint of Gaithersburg in many ways. And who knew? Gaithersburg is the second largest city in Maryland.
It doesn't feel that way when you're there. It feels like a trip through time. It's really, and I love the way you can talk to the authors when you're there. I mean, the National Book Festival is wonderful, but you know, the author is 100 yards away, but not here. Yeah. You just go up and talk to these people.
Yep. So we look forward to that. And everyone should come out. It's in person. First time in a few years, which is fabulous. Okay, we did that. We'll put that piece of paper down. Wait, I have a pop quiz.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I have a pop quiz. Which major celebrity, this is a major celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
This
person, Dolly Parton.
This person has been knighted. No, but I have Dolly's latest. Okay, Dolly, still number two on the New York Times print and hardcover bestseller.
I'd love her.
Is this with James Patterson?
Yes. Would you ever review it, Ron, ever?
Yes, I've reviewed several of Patterson's books.
Oh, but Dolly's?
I have not. I don't. She's reviewed. She's done some children's books, I think, but I don't think she's written a book before that I would.
She wrote, like all things Dolly does, she did this in about 7 minutes with James Patterson, but it's crushing. It's called Run, Rose, Run. Shockingly, it's about a songwriter. And she also wrote 7 songs to go along with the release of the book, which are also crushing. She's the official goddess of this show, Ron.
Yeah, and she gives away tens of millions of books to children.
Yes,
Imagination Library.
Yeah.
It's we think it's up to about 183 million so far that she has given away.
Unbelievable.
And everyone I know who has signed up for it, anyone can sign up for the program to get free books for their kids. Everyone I know who has signed up for it say the books are fabulous and that they just make this pitch to you. The books are free and they just ask you when you're done with them or your kid is done with them, please find a library, please find another kid and pass them along. So it's probably touched more than 175 million kids.
Yeah, we should mention that James Patterson is a huge philanthropist for literacy, too. He's given away millions, possibly tens of millions of dollars now.
Wow. Cool.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Good for them. I had this idea that we at Chatter on Books could do this thing, kind of like Bombas socks. You know, if you buy a pair of socks from Bombas, they give away a pair for free.
I like that.
So I started to consider this thing with bookshop.org. You know, or Libra, one of these, they're really, because we love independent bookstores. So I thought, okay, let's figure something out where if we signed up as one of the affiliates for bookshop.org, and if somebody bought a book from bookshop.org via the Chatter affiliation, then could we give away a book for free?
Very nice.
Very nice. I'd be broke in about 2 weeks.
Yeah. And, you know, if you order through bookshop.com, you're already giving money to independent bookstores through that organization. So you're already doing something good.
Yeah. So we might still do something, but it didn't sound it. You know, once I really, it didn't sound like the socks. It's not as good as socks. Okay, pop quiz. This is a major, major celebrity. And there was an article about 2 weeks ago. If you're in the book world, maybe you saw it. This person has been knighted. And this person revealed, and I just say they, so you don't know a man or woman, that they read two books at a time. And it's usually one fiction and one nonfiction. Who is the celebrity?
Phil Collins.
No, but you're kind of in the right ballpark.
So it is a man if it's been knighted. It's been knighted.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
That kind of sucks, by the way.
Well, what's the female equivalent of knighted?
They become ladies, don't they?
Yeah, they call you a lady, something or other.
Okay.
I'd give up. No.
Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger. He's reading two books at a time.
He reads two books at a time. He's a big reader of, he loves reading about the Ottoman Empire. He loves reading about the Roman Empire. That's what he likes to read about. Yeah, and quite smart about all of it. And you know that there's a series, I don't know which one of the many streaming platforms it's on. It's called Slow Horses.
Oh,
it's really
that.
Great.
That's
right.
Great. Oh,
the washed
so
up,
good.
The washed up MI5 guys, right?
Yes.
Mick Jagger evidently has done some music for it that somehow was inspired by his reading.
Oh, wow.
Right.
I've got to get back to the books because I first, watched the show, which I think is great. And now Nancy Pearl, the nation's librarian, she tells me the novels are wonderful.
Okay. Because there's so much time for all these books, Ron. There's so much time. Okay. So we did that. We did our pop quiz. Okay, book banning.
Oh,
Ron,
It is hard not to be discouraged about this. That it's taken the country by storm, or at least one party in our country by storm.
It's beyond politics. A lot of it is politically driven, politically enhanced. There are political opportunists. But I think, sadly, it's gone beyond that. And when you and I traded emails last week and I said, among other things, let's talk about this because it comes up on the show all the time. And David and I tear our hair out and go, what are people thinking? But I did my usual really exhaustive research and I did a Google search because I wanted to call up some of the things you've written about on this. And so book banning Ron Charles, whatever. Do you remember what you wrote as recently as September of 2018?
That's a long time ago in my world. I do not remember.
Okay. September 26, 2018. This is Ron Charles, people. If you tell anyone, I'll deny it, but I've been irritated for a long time by banned Books Week. Despite my unqualified support, don't you hate Google, Ron?
Nah.
Despite my, someday I'll tell you a Gene Weingarten story. Despite my unqualified support for the freedom to read, the annual celebration, which began Sunday, has always struck me as shrill and inaccurate. That's nice, Ron. Not only disagree with these people, but, really make it personal. I just wish Banned Books Week didn't appear to exaggerate a problem that's largely confined to our repressive past.
Yeah, that piece is totally, totally wrong. That piece should be condemned, and its writer. I mean, everything's changed since then.
It has happened so quickly, though, correct?
Yeah, it got this huge boost from Glenn Youngkin, the new governor in Virginia, who discovered, I think almost accidentally, that running against literature with this absurd campaign against Toni Morrison's Beloved, a book by the greatest novel of the 20th century by a Nobel Prize winner. He had this whole campaign with this bizarre woman who was afraid that her 18-year-old son might be seriously damaged if he read this great novel, and put her up on TV and had her, express her horrible fears into the camera. It's just incredibly pathetic, but it worked and it got him elected. And since then, groups like Moms for Liberty and all kinds of other groups with fake names have been sending out these lists of great books and alarming people with the so-called pornography and filth that's in this book that are going to corrupt our kids. And you've got legislatures all over this country, largely in the South, particularly in Texas and Florida, terrorizing librarians, setting up lines where you can call in and turn in your teacher if they use one of these books, or if they refer to it, or they've referred to teachers as pedophiles. They've referred to them as grooming their students with these books. It is just way, way out of control.
Right.
The victim is, of course, the children and young adults and literature in general in our culture. And I don't know what to do about it except keep raising the alarm week after week.
Yeah. Well, you do it. Well, I think, was it last week even? And I believe it might have been in Florida. Going after math books. They brought in people to evaluate math books.
Yeah, there was lots of racism in the math books they discovered.
Holy cow. Some of the groups, PEN America, it's a nonprofit that advocates for freedom of expression, says more attempts to ban books than ever before. The other one, the American Library Association, that I think you criticized in your 2018 column, Ron. Really nice. Highest number recorded since the association began tracking the phenomenon 20 years ago. This is from a Washington Post story about a month ago. And then I saw one the other day, even more horrifying. Some school, can't remember which state, said, no, the books aren't being banned. We're just not going to have them in the library anymore. And we're going to destroy those copies because we don't need them anymore.
Yeah, that's a really bizarre case. The books were ordered. There were five good novels, one by Dave Eggers, award-winning books, national award-winning books. They ordered the books, but then they discovered that these books contained pornography, as they call it, which is ridiculous. And then they were going to destroy them. Then it got a lot of publicity around the country. Dave Eggers got involved, said he would send anybody in this town in South Dakota a copy of these books if they just wrote to him and asked for them. I think they've backed down from destroying the books, but it's still in limbo. The books are not going to be taught, and they may end up being destroyed.
It's insane. But people like Dave Eggers are fighting back. Have you come across, are you aware of other people, other places that are fighting back in any way?
The real warriors in this are the librarians. They are pushing back. But independent booksellers also play a huge role in this. They've got displays up. Some of them are sending out free books to kids who ask for these banned books. They have displays in their stores. They're keeping this, you know, in the public eye, but you really have to push back hard because these people are everywhere and they're organized online. And when you put out an email like our kids are being corrupted by pornography in school, it is alarming. Of course it's alarming if you're a parent. And it's very hard to sort of undo that damage.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Can we do a happier topic?
Please.
Please. Later tonight, I'll email you that 2018 column. I'm just Googling away, expecting to pick up a couple of your recent, you know, columns, the book newsletter that comes out on Friday to which everyone should subscribe. What's this? It's great. Reminded me. Okay. One of John McCain's favorite lines, God bless him, was, may the words I utter today be sweet, for tomorrow I may have to eat them.
Nice.
Yeah, nice. Okay. Happier topics. Great book cities. America's best book cities.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was surprising to me.
What surprised you about it? Based on indie bookstores, literacy rates, bookish Google searches, and coffee shops, the 50 most populous metro areas and the best of the worst cities for book lovers. Number one, Providence. Number two, Hartford. Three, Boston, San Jose, Seattle, Washington.
Seattle makes a lot of sense. Right. Been there many times. They love their books there.
Right. Yeah. But where's New York?
Not in the top 10.
I think it's number 18.
Not in the top 10. It might have been something to do with lack of, hold on, because you, as you said, this is one of yours. You said the city level data more interesting. San Jose has more indie bookstores per 100,000 people than any other major metropolitan area.
I didn't know that. I'd never heard that.
Yeah. Okay. Then Hartford, Connecticut, they're crazy about libraries. 9.9 libraries per 100,000 residents. That's a lot of libraries.
That is, I think it's twice the national average.
Yeah, that's what you said. Yeah. Do you remember the worst book cities?
It's Vegas and Miami.
Yes, one more.
Stunning development, Vegas.
You're on the right track.
I'm shocked by this.
What was it?
Orlando.
Again, shocked.
So great.
San Jose is where, you know, the liberals that can't afford to live in San Francisco.
Exactly.
I get it.
I think New York City was hurt because the population is so large that it pushes the per capita rate down. And there were some literacy.
It's also literacy rates.
Right. But otherwise they would score high.
Yep.
Okay. But I want them next year. I want them to change their ranking and to include book bannings as part of that, you know, so we see how that affects their ranking and book friendliness.
Right.
Oh, do you want to punish the poor cities though for the crazies in their cities?
I want to punish the cities that have bad school districts that ban books. Yes.
Okay, got it. Got that on the record.
With you.
Okay.
In fact, I want to give. How do I give books away to communities that have had these stupid bannings? How do I do that? Yeah. Who do I talk to about that?
Call the ALA. Or a local bookseller would know.
We could come up with something, David. We could do a chatter in which we have, say, four or five of the authors, the most banned books, the ones that are still living.
I really want to do something about this.
Right? We could do this.
My whole life is based on the fact that I walk up to my library and get a book every week and read it. And
Yeah.
The fact that there are people who won't let children do that is gutting to me.
Yeah. So, and I find myself walking down this path that almost plays right into the hands of the crazy people who want to ban these books, especially, I was an incredibly awkward, terrified, introverted child. And my safe place was going to the library across the street from my kindergarten. Mm-hmm. I went to kindergarten in the afternoon. This is kind of a long story, but it's important. In the afternoons, and my sisters were supposed to walk up the street from the Catholic school and pick me up and walk home from there. Sometimes they did. Sometimes they forgot me. But my safe place was to go into the library, beautiful stone building, take a left-hand turn, take another left-hand turn. And I could sit in this little nook and I could read every book I ever wanted to read about horses. And that saved me. Mm-hmm. And I realized people have far bigger challenges than I do. But I've talked to so many people, including some of our authors, David. They might have been gay. They might have been, you know, black. They might have been something. But they were having problems and they found sanctuary in books.
Sure.
They found sanctuary in books. And to take that away from kids especially, I think is the worst thing.
Well, you mentioned
books don't judge you.
Important point. Yeah, it is. These books are largely books about gay and trans kids, about black kids. I mean, it's the most vulnerable population that's being targeted by these book bans and doing the most damage. And that's why it's so infuriating.
Yeah. And I think you're right, David, that's the right word. And it's non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. The books don't judge you. The books are happy that you're there.
Yes. Please read me.
Yeah. My father judged my book choices at night. He would come in late from work. And if I was still up and reading a book, I would have to have my horse book inside something like pre-calculus for fifth graders. So he wouldn't see the horse book inside. Okay. I see our author, Susan Strait. How are you?
You know, one of my books is on that Texas banned books list.
Really? Which one?
I Wear a Moon, which is fascinating because it came out in 2001 and it's on that banned books list in Texas. And I didn't know, but somebody sent it to me. My daughter lives in Texas.
Wow.
And it's because there's a young woman whose mother was undocumented. And I mean, Ron might remember this book from, it was a National Book Award finalist, and the mom is undocumented. She crosses into Southern California, and now her teenage daughter is 15 and she's pregnant and she's searching for her mom. So that's enough to get it banned. It's got both teen pregnancy and immigration in it. So it's on the list for Texas. And interestingly enough, the mom in that book, Serafina, and her friend Arasali show up in Mecca. I was working on my new book, all of a sudden these characters went into a taqueria and I was like, oh wait, here they're being served by Serafina, who's from High Wire Moon. So the idea that my book would be banned, as you all are saying, is especially hurtful because 85% of my neighborhood and my students are Latino, Latina, and also heavily African-American. So why would you ban a book that's about, and also my mom was an immigrant and did not have a green card until she didn't become a citizen until I was 4. That was to vote for John F. Kennedy, who she thought was very handsome. So I just mean, all of those things meant that I went to the library too. And there were 5 of us kids. We didn't have books unless we went to the library. So everything you all are saying is true. And actually, the 2 people who told me how they felt about libraries was James Baldwin, who was my professor at UMass Amherst. I remember him talking to us about how he went to the library in Harlem, but he couldn't go to like any of the, you know, big Manhattan libraries down south, as he called it. And then Ernest J. Gaines described not being able to go to the library in Louisiana. So the first thing he did when he arrived in Vallejo, California, to live with his mom, was he went to the library. And he said, I didn't see my people on the shelves. And so he said, I read all the Russians, but I didn't see my people. So I feel like I had to write them. And that's the way I have thought about it ever since I heard him say that. So,
that's fabulous.
Libraries are so powerful.
They are powerful. And I heard a story, Susan, we like to do a little bit on the backstory of our authors. I watched an interview with you. You spent a lot of time in libraries as a very small child, and your mother claimed you were reading 50, 60 books a week, something like that. She said you were just reading an extraordinary number of books at one time.
It was crazy. I did read. I mean, I still read all the time. Like, it's just, that's my thing. And my mom was always taking the books away because I had chores. But it's really funny because now my mom has dementia and she comes over here every afternoon. I mean, not today because she usually comes at 3. And she walks around the house and she says, I just don't know what you do with all these books, you know? And it's really funny because she wasn't allowed to go to, like, she had to drop out of high school when she was 15. And so did my dad. So I think of how lucky I was to have read all those books every week. She finally told me the truth. I thought that I, like, learned to read because she took me to a bad babysitter after my dad left and the babysitter was supposedly drunk and dropped me on my head. But my mom's like, no, it wasn't that. That's not why I taught you to read. You wanted to read all the time and you were driving me crazy. You're reading the Quaker Oats box and you're reading like the laundry detergent. So I figured I better get you a book. And then you read the book and then you read it like 4 times and you knew how to read. And then I was in trouble. It's like, okay.
That's good trouble. That is good trouble.
That is good trouble.
For her, it wasn't, but she sort of gets it now. But yeah, now she doesn't have much of a memory. So when I wrote that in the Country of Women, my mom, that came out 2 years ago. My mom couldn't read that book because she's not able to read anymore. So.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. So you were a voracious reader as a small child. Did you always want to write?
No, I mean, I was, like I said, the books were taken away from me, which is very funny because I had chores to do. So I hid them. I read in the tree. I remember like reading in the laundry hamper, but my mom didn't prevent me from reading them as long as my chores were done. But all the books that we read were, it's funny. I have this stack behind me. Uh-huh. There's my original copy of Sula.
Wow.
Another banned book, by the way.
I mean, yeah. I know that Ron brought up Beloved, but this is my favorite book of all time, and I've written about it many, many times.
Nice.
This is literally, this was 75 cents at the grocery store, and I've had it since I was 12, and I didn't understand it at all, of course, when I was 12. I understood the language, but I didn't understand everything that Sula was doing. But I'd have to say I never, ever thought I could be a writer, which is crazy, until... I know most authors must sound much less crazy, but my friends got caught selling drugs when I was 15 and I was with them. And so I got, I wore this ring to show you. So this is an old fork in my high school from the rich, the rich high school kids used to come buy all their marijuana from my friends and my brother. And so if they didn't have money, they could use it. They could bring silverware from their family's house. And then in metal shop, you know, the guys would turn it into a ring. So I got this ring when I was 13.
That is spectacular.
So my girls stole it for a long time. And then I refound it and I polished it up with some toothpaste. So I enjoy wearing it now. But yes, I'm saying all this because
you could have been a drug dealer. We're still waiting for the term of writing because you could have been a drug dealer, clearly.
No, I couldn't have because my mom grounded me and made me go to community college. She was trying to go back and get her education because she didn't get to graduate from high school.
Right.
So she made me go to Riverside City College on the bus. And I was only 15. And, you know, no one asked me anything. And I took a creative writing class. And I wrote some stories. And the professor was so kind to me. And he took me into his office and he said, you are a real writer, but why does everybody die in all the stories? Because every story I wrote was like a beautiful scene in the desert and then this young girl happens upon a dead body. And then he was like, okay. And then the second one was a beautiful scene in the mountains along a creek. And then there's a waterfall and there's a dead body. So he said, do you want to come to my office? Is everything okay at home? And I was like, yeah, why wouldn't it be? But that's because in my house, the only books were the Reader's Digest condensed books.
Sure.
You know, the ones with, sure. And they always have a murder mystery. So I thought the only way you could write fiction was if someone died. And he said, you know, you could write something and no one could die. And I was like, really? That's that doesn't seem right.
Is that allowed?
Yeah. So anyway, I wrote something where someone didn't die. And that was really the beginning, Tori, is that I was 15. But that didn't mean I thought I was going to be a writer. I liked to write, but I was supposed to go be a secretary or a sports writer or something in college. And I was a sports writer for a long time. And then I met Tom Boyle, T.C. Boyle, when I was a senior. I won a prize. And he said, you really have to go to graduate school. So I had never taken a class with him, but he picked out the story and he called me to his office. And he said, I don't understand. Like, what are you doing? You're from Riverside. And I remember looking at him being like, dude, you look like a biker from Fontana. I'm trying to talk to you. And he was like, what are you? And he said, why did you never take a class with me? And I couldn't tell him why. He looked so like a Hell's Angel guy. So he sent me off to graduate school. And then I met James Baldwin. And I was already married when I was 21. And my husband and I met James Baldwin, and he really did change my life in so many ways because he said to me, you have to write about these things. And he used the word imperative. He said, it's imperative that you write about this place. And so it wasn't until then really that, you know, we were already married. We came back home after UMass Amherst, and my husband worked at a juvenile hall. He was a correctional officer. And I taught ESL and I cleaned houses. And that's when I started writing. So,
You sound like one of the rare writers who really enjoys it. We speak to so many authors and so many of them, Ron, I want to hear what you think about this, but so many of them often talk about how hard it is and what a torture it is. And another time we've got a funny story. There's a cafe in Tokyo now that essentially forces writers to write. So some writer is struggling, but they can't just get it done. And so you go into the cafe and you tell them how much do you want them hovering over your shoulder. You pay money for this. And you have to tell them what you're writing about. And then they will help you slog through it.
Like you said, you know, my daughter's here. Mike's husband and his rescue dog were here this morning because he just had COVID. And we're trying to get him to be able to breathe again. My mom's usually here. No one has to tell me to write. I write. In fact, you know, I still write in my car. I wrote entire books in my car. I'm always just wanting an hour to write something. And I know just what you mean, though, is that to be candid with you, even I don't know you guys that well.
Absolutely.
Like, it makes me feel bad because people are like, oh, it must be easy for you to write because you enjoy it. And I'm like, you don't know anything. Like, right now I've got a funeral to plan for my friend Felipe's brother who died at 45. I got another funeral to cook for, I don't know if any of you remember the famous baseball player, Bobby Bonds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bobby Bonds' nephew is my, you know, relative, and Bobby Bonds' nephew just died and he was 70. Oh. So I got to cook for two funerals this week. It makes me sound working class and as if I'm not as intellectual when people are like, oh, it sounds so easy for you. Like, I have to go to the cafe in Tokyo. Dude, how would I even get to the cafe in Tokyo? I'm just trying to get to the Elks Lodge down the street and deliver this food tonight. And I mean, I have darts practice later.
Darts?
Spectacular.
I'm on the darts league at the Elks Lodge.
And, Are you good?
Am I good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
I'm guessing
loving you more and more every minute.
I mean, I don't do this. You know, this is bad. This is our whole world right now. And I don't do this. I throw darts.
That's nice. So, okay. Yeah. The joy of writing. David first and Ron, just because that's alphabetical order. And David, yours is so different because it's often so, there's so much time pressure. Often you get to write longer pieces, but still, when does the joy of writing kick in? David first and then Ron.
The actual joy kick in?
Yeah. Versus the content, if that makes sense.
It's going to sound incredibly egotistical, and I do not mean it to sound that way. But when I write a paragraph that I really like, when I use a phrase or a word, and I know that's the exact right word for the exact point I'm trying to make, it doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah.
But when it does, it's magical. It's just magical when you go, that is exactly what I wanted to convey on the page. That's exactly what I wanted to say.
Nice.
And people can hate it. It's not that I'm not saying everybody's going to love it. I'm going to say I got across what I wanted to get across.
How often does that happen in any given week?
once a year, maybe.
Oh, no.
Ron, how about you?
I feel like you're talking about Kobe and his muscle memory. Like, you know, Kobe's hitting free throws and it's beautiful. Or
No. You know this. It's often dreck. It's often terrible. It's like, this is awful.
But I'm saying when you hit that one that feels really good, it does feel nice. That's the equivalent for us, right?
It's like the if you've ever played golf and you've played 18 holes, and like if you play like me, you take 100, 110 shots to do that, right? But you hit one shot perfectly out of that 110 shots. And you go, well, I'm coming back tomorrow because I hit that one shot. And that's what it's like.
Nice. Ron?
I have to say it's the same for me as what David and Susan said. It is a real pleasure to write. I really enjoy it. I get lost in it. I mean, that's what I want to do. I much prefer it to publishing, which I find really fearful and anxiety ridden and nauseating and just keeps me up. I would rather write than publish.
When you write a line, do you go to David's point, that was a great sentence?
Yeah, but that's a very unreliable reaction because the next day you realize how precious that is, or that you used it before. Or somebody else's line.
Yeah, or 4 years later, it sounds really stupid. Yeah.
You're not going to let that go, are you?
No. What I love, Ron, is you not only disagreed with the band Books Week, you were insulting the people.
I talk to those people almost every week. They have forgiven me. Why can't you?
I'll let it go.
Ron, this is what I say. This is what I say when someone reminds me of something I wrote like that. I just go, yeah, I could have written that. It sounds like me. Possible, I guess.
Oh, it's so great. That's why I don't write. It just makes it simpler when you don't write. Okay. Susan, should we talk about your fabulous book, Mecca?
Yes.
Thank you.
Absolutely
really
fabulous.
Good. And so really cool. Good.
And I'm going to help Ron dig out of his hole because I want to read the first line from his review.
These are lines I will never regret.
Ever. No, I don't want you to. I don't want you. No, this is great. So this was your review from March of this year, Ron. The wind blows hard and hot through the Santa Ana Canyon in Susan Strait's new novel, Mecca. By highway, this is a realm not far from the glitter of Hollywood and the animatronic joy of Disneyland. But by any measure that matters, it's light years away. That's a great line, Susan, right?
I was so thrilled when I received that book review because I felt like this is my 10th book. I published my first book in 1990. Uh-huh. So that was 32 years ago. And I'm still writing about the same place and the same people. And I felt like Ron has always been a great book reviewer and a great friend to novelists. But there are a few people outside of here that really got the landscape and the people the way that he did. And just to say without the usual judgment that yes, I'm not far from the animatronic lives of Disneyland, but to add the word animatronic, I think made all the difference. See, it's just not like the Mickey Mouse, but like here's the fake and here's Hollywood. And then here's my people. I think it was beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I think he nailed it. Okay. Susan, give us the elevator pitch. Give us the CNN headlines version of the plot. And then I'm going to throw something to Ron.
Well, the strangest thing is that I'm working now on the sequel and I have been for some time. And so across the street from me is the Orta family, Johnny Orta, and his uncle Frank Orta was one of the first Chicano motorcycle cops in Riverside. And when I'm playing darts, David, at the Elks Lodge, I'm hanging out with like this other guy named Randy Paramo. And these are old school Mexican-American guys who were cops. And it was really hard to be CHP back then. And so I have another friend, Louis Lozano, who really wanted to be in the CHP and he couldn't. And Louis was kind of the sort of his 20 years he's been sitting on the porch telling me stories. I mean, he's the one that told me how you can kill a guy in three punches because he had this essential loss. He lost his daughter when she was five. And so he became very violent and he was not a police officer. So we just talk and talk. And so Johnny Frias has this secret that he's killed someone. And that was based on a real guy called the Freeway Phantom of the 91 Freeway who used to throw rocks at cars. That was the Johnny Frias part. My mom and I just were talking about that guy last week because she remembers that kind of stuff. But yeah. He shattered 70 windshields.
Oh.
And so when we were learning to drive, that's exactly when it happened. So all my friends remember that. So that was the Johnny Frias part, is that he has a secret buried in one of the canyons. And then the Ximena part, Ximena is a young woman who's just crossed the border. She came from Oaxaca up to Calexico. So she crossed from Mexicali into Calexico. And I was just in Coachella, not for the festival, but for something else. I've written about the guys who set up the festival. I've written about the date gardens in the festival. I meet people all the time that just cross over from Mexicali to Calexico, but you have to cross that All-American Canal. You have to swim sometimes if you go a certain way. I have a friend named Roberto who crossed that canal 25 years ago when he was 17, and his 16-year-old brother drowned and floated away from him. And Roberto would still cry if I were to ask him about it. 25 years he'd been telling me that. So these are both like stories people told me. And then the last person, Madalas, is another of the big plot people. And she's a single mom who works as a florist at Conroy's. And for me, her thing was, you know, how you be a single mom and you're raising these boys and you're driving on the freeways and just trying to survive. And I liked her a lot because she reminds me of all my friends. So
I love the diversity of the characters. But I'm sorry, Ron, I want to go to you first. I could just keep reading your review because it was beautiful and it was beautifully written. But give us the snapshot. What was it that you liked so much about this book? Because you don't review that many books. You write about a lot of things going on in the book world, but you don't review that many. And you really like this.
I really like this book because this book took me to a place that I knew nothing about and introduced me to characters who are very common in America, but I never run into. I never meet. They're friends of Susan's. They're not friends of mine here in Bethesda. I don't know these people, but I know they are important in America. And I want to hear them and I want to know them and I want to see them in a way that's honest and real and that breaks through all the cliches and the racism, but also just the superficiality that I think we regard people that clean up after us, who are nurses in our hospitals, who take care of a horticulture and agriculture in this country, people that we just look over, that we just glance by. This novel takes us into their lives in a way and makes us know them and care about them. And that's all I want from any novel, really. Yeah.
What one of the things that struck me is that there are so many different wonderful characters, and there's a highway patrolman. There's the recent immigrant. There's the single mom trying to raise her kids. And Susan, you so perfectly, I think, capture all their voices. I'm like, Ron, living in Chevy Chase, Maryland, I'm not hanging with these people a lot. But I think you perfectly capture their voices. Were any of those characters harder than others? Or which ones to whom did you relate the most? But I just thought I never found Ron, again, I'm going to tread cautiously because whenever I try to pretend like I actually know anything about writing, I get in trouble. But I thought every character got equal footing, if that makes sense. And every character, it seems to me like you're very patient. Every person in the story got equal presentation and equal presence. And was that hard? Did you feel equally comfortable being Johnny, being him? You know, who did you feel most comfortable writing?
That's a good question. No one's asked me that yet. I mean, I have to say, I appreciate what you guys are saying because as I've been traveling around, especially in California, you know, I did something here in my hometown and there were about 150 people there and three of my neighbors came. So I have five neighbors who are nurses.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've been in my house 35 years and some of the nurses I like went to high school with. Like on a normal day, I'll see somebody I went to kindergarten with.
Uh-huh.
And I still see them all the time. So my friends came and they said, no one ever writes about nurses. Like they couldn't believe it. And afterwards, one of my friends, Marsha, she said, you know, every day I'm walking to work on the way to the hospital because the hospital where I was born is only three blocks away. And so during COVID, especially a lot of women were walking because they didn't want to get their cars infected, just like what happens in the book.
Right.
And Marsha said, you always stand there at, you know, and you always listen to me talk. And she said, but I never ever realized like that you really do listen to me because I see myself. And so that part, Tori, is pretty easy. I know so many guys like Johnny Frias,
mm-hmm.
you know, David's laughing, but if I'm at the lodge throwing darts, those are the stories I hear. And like, why wouldn't I want to write about CHP guys or, you know, a guy who's an animal control officer, by the way. Like, there's a Black animal control officer, and yeah. people are like, what? But that's the thing. Like, that's not unusual. And to be an animal control officer out here, you got bears, mountain lions, raccoons, right. possums, bobcats. Like, these are normal stories where people are like, yeah, had to tranquilize a Black bear again in Yucaipa at the 7-Eleven. They're like, you know, he was just like roaming around. And so that part isn't hard. The hardest part for me to write was Angel Wings, which is the character, the story where there's a young man who's shot. That one I can't look at because I've had so many people in my family, you know, family and friends have died. Not only at the hands of police, but also lots of gang violence, lots yeah. and lots of gang violence. So that one's hard. And I wrote that one for Chris Ying at ESPN Magazine in like 2010. Yeah. He asked us, actually Dave Eggers and a bunch of other people, he asked to write for a special sports fiction issue. And everybody else turned in stories about like baseball and golf. And then I wrote this story called Angel Wings about somebody getting killed. And my kids are like, what are you doing? And it was because that's how I was feeling at that time. I was feeling like so many young Black men around me were getting cut down. And so that story, I can't look at that one. Read it out loud.
Isn't that the one that touched you the most?
Yeah, I didn't realize it had been published before. I think it's a remarkable story. And I think it will be, if it isn't already, anthologized for a long time. It really is.
Nope, it's never been anthologized. And it's funny because I changed it a lot, Ron, for the book, because I realized that Mary and Lorette were cousins, right? And that affected Dante and those other things. But no one's ever written to me about that story. It's never been anthologized. It's really weird. It just kind of, I enjoyed seeing it at ESPN, and then nothing happened. But that was before anybody was paying attention, you know?
We
were paying attention because it was happening all the time, but
The content of that story, but also the way it's told, is just a remarkable piece of work.
I just want to tell you, Susan, just two things. Number one, my mom was a nurse, so anytime anyone writes about nurses, I'm thrilled beyond measure. And just the notion that I'm so glad I read this book, because for 30 years, when you fly in and out of Los Angeles, the first thing you ask is, are the Santa Anas kicking up? Am I going to get hit by the Santa Anas on takeoff or on landing?
Yeah.
And they're just this thing that you just kind of think about for 5 or 10 minutes while your plane is taking off or landing. And then you don't think about them anymore. And to think that there's an entire world of people who live there. Oh my God. Like, you just opened my eyes up. That's just so, it's fantastic. Thank you.
Funny because they're blowing today. If I were to show you, they're just blowing a little bit today, but it's already real hot. It was 100 degrees yesterday.
Yeah.
And the wind is blowing. And my middle daughter lives in Harlem right now. She's a fellow at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Mm-hmm. And her husband is there with her. He's from Nigeria. And what they miss is they miss the wind. And when they come home, she's always like, I mean, not the crazy wind where, you know, everything's breaking. But she just says, I just miss the wind. Like, I miss the feeling of the wind and the trees above me. So it's a funny thing, David, but like, people miss lots of stuff, but that middle kid, she's the only one. She'll be like, I miss the wind, Mom. I miss you, but I miss the wind. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, I get it.
Related to the wind, it struck me, this book, as anybody who listens to the show knows, I tend to think visually. This is one of the first, I think the only book I've ever read where I felt things. And this is kind of a process question, Susan. But I could feel, to David's point about nursing, I could feel the bone-crushing fatigue of nurses working through COVID. I could literally feel the heat coming off the Jeep going to Coachella, to the desert. Do you have to think about creating that kind of sense, or is it just organic for you?
I think that I am the same as Ron and David in that, I mean, I'm a good mom, I'm a good cook, I'm good at a few things, but like, I'm put on earth to write. That's what I do. And it makes me, when I'm writing at night and I'm in that Jeep with Model S, I know that Jeep because my ex-husband still has that car. And he'll be like, you know, turn the heat on. And the girls are like, what are you talking about? Your air conditioning, bro. You turn on the heat, turn on the heat. And we're going to die now. But It's just a thing. And the nurses, you know, again, so many nurses in my neighborhood. That's just like where I live. And when they would just tell me the stories of how long their day or their night was, it was the craziest thing, that the little details they would tell me. Like, it was like Dante, the story I was writing about Dante, you know, I knew his mom, Lorette, was a nurse, but I had started that story before COVID. And then, I mean, that chapter before COVID. And then in my mind, she was in hospice care, taking care of somebody. And all of a sudden I'm like, no, she's at St. Bernardine's and it's COVID. Yeah. For someone like Lorette, like my friends, you watch these big grown men and they have to lie on their stomachs. And you know what they tell me? That they get ready and they go in the ICU and they just see all these feet. And for men, not trying to sound crazy, but it's so vulnerable to have a man on his stomach and have his bare feet. That's just not something you see, is it? Mm-hmm. That's not something. Men always wear shoes. This is men don't be running around barefoot and lie down and you can see their feet. It's just not a thing. Right. And so that broke my heart. And so Tori, like, just to imagine, because I finished this book and in November, my ex-husband got COVID and he almost died and he was in the ICU. And there he was, 6'4", 330 pounds, lying on his stomach with his bare feet. And he said, I don't want to lie on my stomach. I don't like nobody looking at my feet. And I just was like, you know.
Wow.
I mean, it was, I've not ever had something happen like where he got sick, just like Grief Embers, that character got sick. And it really shook me. And then one of my neighbors just died of COVID, like last month. Across the street, my neighbor across the street, Jim Calderon. So it's hit all these men in my world, these large brown men and white men. But to write like that, actually, it made me feel better at night. Like I could imagine being somewhere else and not just worrying about myself, you know, and who was going down in my family. So
it's Ron, I'm going to say this carefully. It's very selfless. It's very selfless writing. Is that right, Ron?
Yeah, I think that's, I wouldn't have thought of that, but that is true.
It's so not.
In Riverside, we raise with no ego. Because if you say something good about yourself, you will get beat down. That's why David's like, are you good at darts? I'm like,
yeah,
I don't know. Someone's like, are you good at something? You're like, I don't know. Because if you say you're good, then someone's like, oh, okay. Then let me come at you. And so we're like, I'm not good at anything.
Right.
I've got a very good friend who's Danish, and that's a very Danish thing. If you're Danish, you don't brag. So, for instance, if you had a, you know, say you had a restaurant, you would never put a sign out in the street that says we have the best sausage.
No,
just wouldn't do
that's
it.
That's a very Filipino thing too.
Yeah,
because I mean, I grew up near an Air Force base, so I have so many friends who are Filipino or half Filipino. In the Philippines, if you name your kid something like really pretty, and your kid's beautiful, then the gods are going to come take him. So you name your kid like Ugly Head. Seriously. And then like here in the working class culture where I live, you don't be bragging on stuff. Cause if you're bragging on it, then you must want somebody to come and get it. Right. So,
Okay. I'm going to continue to struggle along and try to find that there's some process or structure to how you do these things. There were so many great single lines in the book, Susan, and I found myself putting stickies. But this is just an example. And I read lines in this book that I just, unlike anything I've ever read before. The kitchen was my mother's small dance of efficient. Mm-hmm. It's such a, Ron, that's just an incredible use of words, isn't it?
Read a whole book piled up with lines like that is a real pleasure.
Yeah.
You guys are going to get me in trouble later in the day. See, I'm going to go out and I'm going to be a little big-headed.
We're cursing you. We're absolutely cursing you.
The book sucked, Susan. It was terrible. Okay, there you go. You can say that.
I need to, like, not do anything else, you know, vocal for the rest of the day.
I also think her treatment of racism, I mean, we all know racism is bad and it's immoral, but what she points out is that it's also absurd because these people have been here for hundreds of years. And to have these white people who are relative newcomers come in and treat them as though, you know, these brown people just arrived is laughable. In addition to being hateful and cruel, it's also laughable. And she plays on that again and again in the cleverest ways.
Yeah, the whole sense of who was here first, yeah. Not people that look like Tori and Ron.
No.
Well, I would have to say that so growing up like I did, I mean, I look as white can be. Uh-huh. And my mom is from Switzerland and my stepdad's from Canada, right? So, you know, in my high school, it was like a third Black, a third Mexican-American, not Mexican-born, like a third Chicano. Mm-hmm. And then white, Japanese-American, a lot of indigenous people. So, you know, I was just at my high school last week for a fundraiser, for a scholarship fundraiser. And I see everybody all the time because we go to like high school reunion at like Duke's Bar and Grill, which is everyone's like, you guys go to Duke's? And we're like, yeah, of course we do. I have to say that I was the immigrant kid. Like all of my Mexican-American friends, their people had been here since 1880. Right. Or like I grew up with the Trujillos. They were actually my friends, the Trujillos, that we went to school together. They were a big inspiration for the Rancho in Chino because their people came in 1843 and they lived in the next town over from me. And they were brought from New Mexico by like the Lugo family, like the original California ranchers, you know, from Spain. They were brought to guard the cattle in 1843. So when someone would say to one of the Trujillos, like, go back to Mexico, they'd be like, I've never been to Mexico. Like, where are you from?
Right.
And that was such a very interesting way to start that book because I was the immigrant. And my mom wasn't a citizen and my dad wasn't a citizen until they met when I was four. So I think maybe that's why I don't have the same way of looking at it like someone from the South or someone from Oklahoma. Is that I think my mom learned to speak English from listening to Vin Scully do Dodger broadcasts. So I always knew there was something off about my mom's English, but she doesn't use slang. She doesn't know any slang. She still sounds like Vin Scully, right? So part of it was...
So great.
I know.
So great.
Part of it was this thing where, like, when I was growing up, I could speak Spanish. I learned French from someone from Louisiana. Miss Dauphine was my teacher. Just all of the ways that Johnny looks at language were the ways that I looked at language. Like, why do we say holy smokes? Like, what is that even?
Right.
And so I love writing about this place. I love writing about regional fiction because I learned really from all the great writers of regional fiction, which is everybody from Larry Brown, you know, to, again, thinking about writing about Ernest J. Gaines. You know, one of my favorite things to do is to look at all the books that came out of New York and how differently everybody speaks in all those books. So I always wanted people to understand how we spoke here is that we don't say que pasa, which everyone thinks is Spanish. If people here would be like, bro, que pasó, you know, like that. And you would say that no matter what race you are. And people will be always like, you better show me the dinero. And like a Black guy would be like, show me the dinero. Like, it wouldn't even be a thing. Yeah. So I like writing about this place.
And we could go on for 45 minutes in there about language. Because again, if somebody had told me before I'd read this book, Susan, oh, and there's this whole thing about language, I would just get immediately turned off. It's spectacular. It's Johnny who speaks English and Spanish fluently, but he's still trying to figure out the cultural references, if you will. And you have Jimena, who is trying to learn not only how to speak English and what to say, but as importantly, what not to say. It was fascinating. Okay, I don't want to subject you. You're just too brilliant, and the book Mecca is too good to subject you to 60 seconds more, so we won't do that because that's just too embarrassing. You are all in on California, and you're all in on your part of California, which, going back to Ron's lead, it's not the animatronic. It's not about Venice, the beaches, etc. What is it that you love so much about your part of California?
You know, I will confess to you all, because I've always wanted to tell Ron this, and I emailed Ron. Maybe I emailed you like in 2017 or 2018.
I bet he didn't answer. Did he reply?
No, I didn't expect him to, but he was the first person I emailed about it. I made this map, this literary map of America, like of regional fiction, and it had 737 books on it back then. And I ended up putting it on Granta. I just did a new version of the map this fall, in December. It now has 909 books, and that's because our area code was the 909 back then.
Uh-huh.
I think I love that everyone hates us, and I love that we're considered useless. But I also know now that my daughter's in New York, it's physical. Like my three girls are young Black women who were raised, you know, they have grandparents who were descendants of enslaved people in Mississippi, in Tennessee, and then went through Tulsa. And then they have Swiss in them. And there's also the mystery of my mother-in-law never knew her father. We all like arrived here. And so we grew up, you know, I grew up, like you said, my best friend, her mom was from the Philippines and her dad was American. Uh-huh. And my other best friend, his mom was from Japan and his dad was African-American from Texas. Like when you grow up like that, I don't think there's any other way to move through the world except for to be like, this is our promised land. And so that's why we all stayed here. Because A, there's oranges on the tree right now, you know, and somebody will bring me by some tacos later. And, you know, I used to have chickens. Like, we're very self-sufficient. Yeah. And maybe it's because we're working class that I always wanted to write about, like, the river, like the Santa Ana River that's near me.
Yeah,
the Anza Crossing. I walk. I don't tell this story, but I'll tell you guys. My brother-in-law is bigger than my ex-husband. There's four boys. My brother-in-law is 6'6 and weighs 385.
Oh.
So he's a security guard. He was the inspiration for Darnell, the character in Black Iron and Thousand Midnights. He used to be a firefighter, but he didn't learn to read or write well, so he couldn't pass the test. So he'd been a cement contractor, and now he's a security guard. So he was working at Anza Crossing at nighttime, graveyard shift, watching the cranes and, like, the county equipment. There were guys stealing cranes, like, stealing a crane. I was like, who bought the crane? He's like, I don't know. Somebody does. So I got in here and watched the cranes and the water buffaloes. And the water buffaloes are the trucks that are filled with water to water down the project. So anyway, my brother-in-law, I go take him some cake and some sandwiches. And at nighttime, the coyotes could smell the food that I brought him. And they would attack his truck, like 20 coyotes.
Then
he's right there by the Anza Crossing. And he swore he could see ghosts. Because that's where Juan Antonio Anza crossed in 1774.
Wow.
And I always think, how does nobody know, like, California's got history too? Ours isn't like Jamestown or whatever, but ours is pretty crazy as well. And I love, what I love about home is that every day someone tells me an amazing story like that.
Yes.
Every single day. I could never write them all down. So I feel like I'm in a land of great storytellers, and also the wind and the oranges and the smell of the orange blossoms. I don't think I could replicate that anywhere else.
It's spectacular. It is absolutely spectacular. I think we should leave it
there. You're the best guest we've ever had. I'm just going to say that. You're the best guest we've ever had.
Absolutely.
The best author we've ever had.
Absolutely.
I feel like I told you appalling and terrible things.
No, it's wonderful. I'm going to read the last line from Ron's review about Mecca. Remarkably, the most persistent impression here is not one of suffering, but of determined survival, even triumph. It's a good line, Ron.
Thank you.
It's a good line. Susan Strait, it is just an honor to meet you. I hope you keep getting inspired by where you are and where you live and the people you hang out with and your dart competitions. And I hope you just keep writing. I hope you will come back. But we really appreciate you joining us tonight. Just great.
This was so much fun because I started out being a little bit nervous about you guys. But then David's like, wait, you throw darts? And then I was like, oh, okay. I guess it's not that embarrassing. I am appalled that I told you the story of the ring, but there is that. And
that's spectacular.
I love this so much. Are you kidding me? No.
Thank you,
like,
all for having me.
A normal person. Good for you.
Thank
you all for having me. And it made me happy to be able to talk about the book with you. So.
It's fabulous. Thank you for being with us. Love you, my friend. Ron Charles, love you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Come
thank
back.
Thank you.
Susan, come back with the next one, okay?
I would love to. Thank you.
Excellent. Everyone who's listening, thank you so much. Come out to Gaithersburg this Saturday in person. David and I will be there. At least I will be there.